Hello everybody and welcome to the podcast Wspólny Świat, Wszystko co najważniejsze. I have a pleasure of talking today to Migration Editor at Large of the New Humanitarian, Eric Reedy. Hello and thank you for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, because today's topic of our conversation is, well, EU migration policy in Libya, something that you wrote extensively on when it comes to the subject. And last year we had a big protest and big strike of migrants and refugees in Libya. When it comes to the living conditions there, we had cases of abuses and very like disrespectful and very hurtful treating of people who were looking for maybe a better life in Europe that were kept in Libya. Since then, the focus of the situations of people there shifted to other topic and other regions of the world. But it's important to maybe ask at the beginning, why is Libya so important, and what is happening there since the publication of so many reports also by the New Humanitarian on the abuses that are happening there, that are cases of migrants and refugees? Has there been any change in situations in Libya?
Yeah, so I guess it might be important just to start with some brief background about the situation in Libya and why it is such a focal point in terms of what is happening in the Mediterranean when it comes to migration. And so basically, Libya for a long time has been a beginning point for journeys across the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa to Europe, but the situation became particularly pronounced in 2013, 2014, in sort of the authority vacuum that came to exist in the country post-revolution and the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime. And what we saw develop during that time period was initially a very robust and lively migration industry, people, smuggling industry, sending people across the Mediterranean. And there were always a certain amount of abuses inherent in that, but the situation became much worse after 2017 and 2018 for asylum seekers and migrants in Libya, because the EU sort of consolidated a plan or a strategy to try to prevent boats from departing from Libya, or to prevent boats that departed from Libya from reaching the EU by funding and providing various forms of support to the Libyan Coast Guard. And so then what happened is we saw, instead of the monetization of movement in Libya, where the various militias and smuggling gangs were making money off of people paying to cross the sea, the same groups started to try to find other ways to extract value, if you will, from the people who wanted to migrate because they weren't able to actually move them across the Mediterranean so easily. And so they started extorting people, they started torturing people, they started using them as forced labor with more and more frequency. And again, all of those sorts of abuses were happening in the past, but the intensity and the sort of systematic way in which it happens in both official and unofficial Libyan detention centers really escalated post 2017.
So what do we know actually that is going on? Because there was few reports that New Humanitarian published. There was also a report by Ian Urbina from The New Yorker about the actions of European Union, how they contributed, how we contributed as European Union to the prosecution actually of people in Libya. So what do we actually know? Like, what kind of abuses are going on there? What is the condition that people live in?
Yeah. So the cycle of abuse, and particularly the European Union's involvement in that cycle of abuse, starts with the European Union's support for the Libyan Coast Guard. And that takes a couple of forms. One is the training of Libyan Coast Guard personnel. Another is the provision of equipment. A lot of the majority of the boats that the Libyan Coast Guard uses are actually provided by Italy, their former Italian Coast Guard or Navy boats that are donated by Italy, training, equipment maintenance, and more recently, Frontex, the EU border agency, is sharing information about boats departing from Libya with the Libyan Coast Guard. Drone surveillance in the central Mediterranean, relaying the coordinates of boats that have departed to the Libyan Coast Guard so that the Libyan Coast Guard can intercept them and bring these people back to Libyan detention centers. And so what we know about what happens to people who are brought back to Libya is that they're automatically detained. There's no legal path for exiting migration detention in Libya. And the people in these detention centers, you know, the sanitary conditions are terrible. They're overcrowded. Detention centers are largely run by militias or, you know, state entities that are affiliated militia with various militia leaders. There's physical abuse, there's sexual abuse, there's forced labor. So there's all sorts of deprivation and, you know, various forms of abuse that are taking place in these detention centers.
You mentioned Coastal Guard of Libya, but like knowing what is the situations up there in Libya, it's hard to say about some organized structure of institution that we can think of when we think about Coastal Guard. So what actually, with whom do we actually cooperate as European Union?
Yeah, so the Coast Guard is, the situation has shifted a bit over time, but the security apparatus of the Libyan state in general is distributed among various leaders, and a lot of them are militia affiliated. So when we talk about the Coast Guard, the Coast Guard in Tripoli might be different from the Coast Guard in Zawada. There might be a faction, you know, technically they're under the same umbrella, but they might not be aligned with the same political interests at a particular point in time, and that shifts, that shifts as the politics inside of Libya shift as well.
Okay, so we have Libya is a kind of a very much important place when it comes to migration to Europe. A lot of people, like you mentioned, asylum seekers can't even have the possibility of claiming the asylum or even like trying to apply for it because like there are taking back all the time. Like, who are the people? Like, we know that, for example, right now there was a report about people from Sudan trying to find their way to Europe, trying to go north. Who are the people? Why they are coming to Libya?
Yeah. Libya, because it is a sort of beginning point for the journey across the Mediterranean, it attracts a lot of people from different places who are leaving their homes for various reasons. You have people from West Africa, from the Sahel region. You have people from East Africa. In the past, a lot of Eritreans who have suffered particularly egregious abuses in Libya. You also have people from Bangladesh in South Asia who are transiting through Libya, trying to reach Europe. You have Syrian refugees and asylum seekers. You have Tunisians and Algerians, and at times you also have Libyans as well, who are, you know, escaping the political chaos and economic situation in their own country.
Yeah, what is important, I think, here is like most of the nationalities here, like every person of an asylum seeker and refugee is a personal, of course, personal case, but most of this country, those people probably have some kind of claim or de facto claim actually to the refugee protection.
Yeah, and there are very, very strong push factors. There's particularly in the European conversation, there's a lot of conversation about the pull factors, quote unquote pull factors that encourage people to you know, take these incredibly dangerous journeys. But in reality, you know, and I think all of the sort of research about migration decision making, the push factors are way more influential than the pull factors are. The places that people are coming from, you know, whether it's drought and desertification and the way that overlaps with conflict and resource scarcity, or whether it's direct political persecution, wars, et cetera, you know, there are incredibly strong push factors that are, influencing people's decision to take incredible risks to go to Libya in the first place, to try to cross the Mediterranean.
Let's dig in into this, because it's kind of a, like when we mention the discussion right now and political debate right now in European Union, there are a few narratives, few different perceptions about the issues there, but most of the, of course, attention gets to the security issues. So we can see what is going on, for example, sometimes in Spain when there are people from Ceuta coming or from other regions, and every time we have this kind of discussion, we have the issue of what kind of security do we want, or do we raise the issue of security, or that we have to protect, or some other form of verbs that we use to explain the issue of our borders as European Union. So when it comes to positionality, you as a journalist who works in European Union, deals with the issues there, what do you think about this issue of securitization or security when it comes to the situation, for example, in Libya?
Yeah, I mean, the security argument stands in tension with the European Union's commitment to humanitarian principles as well. And, you know, the commitment to providing refuge to people who are fleeing war, persecution, et cetera. And oftentimes the security argument, you know, throughout history has functioned to, you know, I think we can see this in the Ukrainian situation as well, because, you know, the narrative for a long time in the European Union was there are too many people coming from the Middle East, North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa. We don't have the capacity to handle these kinds of numbers. But now in a, you know, short period of time, in 7 or 8 months, there are about 5 million Ukrainians who have registered for temporary protection in the EU. And suddenly there's the capacity, because there's the political will, to manage this in a way that is humane, that is dignified, where, you know, European states across the board are pretty much all trying to do their best in order to make sure people have housing, people have access to the labor market, people have access to schools, people don't have to worry about, you know, their legal status, at least in the short term. And so it's really turned this question of capacity on its head. And this is where the securitization argument comes in. These arguments about border security throughout history in the European context, in the US context, have often been directed towards migrants and asylum seekers who are of a different religion, a different nationality, a different race. And so you see them tied in with, you know, with racist narratives, with Islamophobic narratives, et cetera, throughout time in history. So I think we really have to look at the securitization argument with a historical perspective about how it's been used historically, and also with sort of a critical perspective about how it intersects with race and, you know, religion and forms of discrimination in that way.
Well, in 2015, when we had, first that big of influx of people to European Union, I believe that all Italy also wanted to actually apply the temporary protective agreement, but there wasn't any will to actually do it at the time. So do you think that situations right now when it comes to Ukraine can give us some positive light on the future of what we as Europeans will do to keep our borders in safe, of course, at the same time, but also do it in a more humane way?
Yeah, I think that definitely if it is a lesson and approach that, you know, people want to replicate, I think it has proven that there is a more humane, more sustainable, more organized way to approach managing migration at the EU's external borders. The big question is whether the political will exist to replicate the approach in other contexts.
So one more question and the hardest questions at the end. So there are many NGOs involved in the issue. Not also European Union, but we have IOM, we have UNHCR, we have all the NGOs that are somehow involved in the issue of course, refugee protection, but also in the situation in Libya. It's hard to imagine any way forward when it comes to what we're discussing, humanitarianism, and trying to change a bit the way that EU management system works without the involvement of those organizations. Of course, there is a lot of discussion, a lot of criticism sometimes towards those organizations, but do you think that there is a positive light maybe in that sense, that do they give a good example when it comes to Libya, or do they not?
Do the UN agencies give a good example when it comes to Libya, or just
NGO, IOM, UNHCR, other organizations involved when it comes to raising the issue of human rights when it comes to EU policy, EU migration policy?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because the role that that UN agencies, IOM, UNHCR have played in Libya, and also the international humanitarian agencies or organizations that operate in Libya. First of all, Libya is an incredibly difficult context for these organizations to operate in. And when it comes to the UN, also, I mean, the UN is a state-based organization, so
you need to negotiate position to actually give help, yeah, but also like keep be in the ground. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what the UN is able to do in a particular context is confined by the state that is giving it permission to operate within its borders, and then also by the member states that are defining the mandate and also funding the operations of the particular agencies that are operating. And so in Libya, there's been a lot of criticism about the way that UN agencies have been sort of co-opted into the EU's border externalization policy. So, the push and pull of EU policy is, on the one hand, the EU provides all of this support material and operational support to the Libyan Coast Guard. And on the other hand, it donates money to UN agencies to try to improve conditions in Libyan detention centers. We're 5 years into the process of trying to improve conditions in Libyan detention centers, and nothing has improved. There's no demonstrable improvement. But if you ask, an EU spokesperson about the Libya policy, they'll be like, we're doing this to secure our borders and to help Libya secure its borders, and we're doing this to try to mitigate the human rights defense, the human rights situation in the detention centers. But if you ask any sort of human rights organization, they'll say that the mitigation effort has been an abject failure. And so that raises the question of, the UN agencies are, instrumental in that, playing that role. I guess the counter side to that argument is, okay, would it be worse if they weren't there? And so there's always this tension that exists, but there's definitely, I think a relatively fair critique being made of the way that these UN agencies have sort of been involved in the process of EU border externalization. So I think that's a fair critique to make, and an important question to push to these agencies to have to answer.
And with that questions, we will leave our today conversation. Thank you very much, Eric, for this important conversation. We'll of course follow up with the issues of Libya and the situations there. And well, personally, I do hope that some conclusions and some good conclusions we will be able to make after these few difficult months of also the situation in Ukraine, but also after all these reports that we have because of journalism and because of good work of many people, also from the NGOs, also from the big NGOs, about the situations that are going on in Libya. So we'll follow up with this situation. Thank you very much for conversation. That was a conversation with Eric Reedy from the New Humanitarian, migration editor at large. Thank you very much, Eric. And this was podcast Wspólny Świat. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.